It's time for the second hour of the Dr. and Mrs. Future Show.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Ladies and gentlemen, KSCO presents the Dr. Future Show. If you would like to join in our show today, you can call us at 831-479-1080. That's 831-479-1080. And now, your host, Dr. Future.
Hey, folks, welcome back to the show. Welcome back, Mrs. Future.
Why, thank you, honey.
Welcome back, Bobby, our science correspondent in San Fran. You there?
Yes, welcome back, yes.
Okay, good. Well, in this hour, we're going to be speaking with Dr. Ralph H. Abraham, who is one of our esteemed elders at the university here in Santa Cruz, father of chaos theory.
I love knowing someone who's the father of chaos theory.
Mathematician.
So cool.
professor of math since 1968, founded director of the Visual Math Institute, Visual Math, at the beginning of computer graphics around that time. And author of philosophical books, Chaos, Gaia, Eros, has done trilogies with Rupert Sheldrake and Terence McKenna, Chaos, Cosmos, and Creativity, I believe was their trilogue. Worked on elementary school kid programming. William Irwin Thompson, somebody who has affected me as a kid, cultural historian. You worked with him on a project. And he's got a new book called Vibrations and Forms, Findings from Psychedelic Adventures. Psychedelic Adventures. Welcome, Ralph.
Yes. Oh, thanks so much for that introduction. It helps me to get to know myself.
Well, we're hoping it's you and not a virtual version of you. But even if it is, it would be a pleasure.
I didn't really catch up with the technology of the past yet.
Yeah. It's never ending. And it still gives me hope.
And yeah, I think of you as somebody who paved the way, Ralph. You know, you gave people so many ways to visualize and expand their modeling, their ability to model with computers.
So. Well, yes. Modeling is so important, and it's not generally understood, I think, that almost everything we think is a model. Mm. We don't even know what reality is, but we've evolved models based on sensory perceptions, imaginations, and conversations, and multimedia, et cetera, et cetera.
Does that mean language itself is just a model?
Well, yes, and it's such a poor model because it's great for everything you can express, but there's so many things you want to express that don't fit into language, and that's why those things, I don't know the name for them.
The ineffable.
The primal thoughts.
Yeah, the wonderful word, ineffable. It's beyond ineffable. It belongs to, let's say, higher levels of consciousness or cosmic mind that are not acknowledged as existent by many people, especially materialists, scientists, and down-to-earth people like that. And one reason those mystical levels are so mystical is just because they're ineffable. Mm-hmm. Our experiences that don't fit into language can hardly be discussed or advanced in the dialogue of intellectuals over the centuries and millennia.
Like merely referenced through the language.
Well, I really appreciate how much about that journey that you took, you shared in your book, Vibrations and Form. And I'd love to share some of that with the audience. Just let's start with when you were a young teacher in Europe, in Amsterdam, and then you took a summer and went to visit Neem Karoli Baba in his ashram, and you spent some time in a cave just beginning to understand the nature of consciousness. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, and wasn't that the same teacher that Steve Jobs wanted to see?
That's true. Yes. Well, the book Vibrations and Forms is not a newly written book. It's a collection of articles that I wrote over the years, beginning about that time in India in 1972, and up until, it's not current, this volume goes up until, you know, just 2 or 3 or 4 years ago. Mm. And the chapters are presented in chronological order. So if you could, speed read through it, which I admit is difficult, then you would see how my model of consciousness gradually advanced in several stages. Mm-hmm. So the beginning of it all, the vibrations and forms, a sequence of papers, there are two routes. One is LSD and DMT experiences in the 1960s, and the other is that visit to India, where I stayed in the ambience of Nim Karoli Baba for about 7 months. And I had instruction, it seemed that I had information coming from Nim Karoli Baba that arrived in my dreams or something, but appeared in these dreams to be a conversation, like a lecture or something. And these were attempts to explain to me the intellectual version of my own psychedelic experience. So those two things, the psychedelics and India, came together in this period of 7 months in the Himalayan foothills.
I had a question from Nick Herbert, a fellow scientist colleague in this arena, who was wondering if there was something in particular you saw on your acid trip that tuned you into these higher levels of awareness, mathematics, et cetera.
Well, yes, but I say Nick Herbert is a scientist. I am not, as I think mathematics and science are kind of disjoint.
Really? That's interesting.
Yes, what I saw in my experiences, particularly with DMT, appeared to be, was interpreted by me as being a view of higher consciousness itself. Hmm. That is, the consciousness had different levels, and the higher levels are hidden from us by something like a marine layer of clouds. Hmm. And with psychedelics and other means like meditations, austerities, or whatever, it's possible to peek through little holes in these clouds and get a glimpse of what's going on upstairs. And that was how I interpreted the experience of these extraordinary, multidimensional, colored, vibrating, chaotic, complex, dynamical visualizations. It went on and on at fantastic speed, for it seemed like forever. A DMT trip only lasts a few minutes, but it seems like hours and hours of instruction and how it is on a level beyond ordinary perception of the reality that produces ordinary perception by means of some kind of condensation down layer upon layer, down, 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 to denser and denser and slower vibrations until you get to ordinary reality.
Matter and such.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to go to a break right now, and then we're going to come back and talk more about the relationship of the rest of consciousness and the universe and the condensation that we're all experiencing together.
Thought on matter, too. I'm interested in the cymatics.
Okay.
All right.
All right. We'll be right back with our guest, Ralph Abraham.
Welcome back to the show. We're just talking to Dr. Ralph Abraham on his new book, Vibrations and Form.
Which I thoroughly enjoyed.
Oh, yes.
I haven't finished it yet, but I've read quite a bit of it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, she brought it on a ski trip. You sent it just in time for us to take to Tahoe. And it was very popular there. So, Ralph, after you've had your mind expanded to such an extent, you still have your mind after that. So one of the things you mentioned in the book is that you went to investigate something called cymatics to understand, I guess, what's next after you have, you know, an expanded experience like that. Can you tell us a little bit about cymatics?
Well, yes. This is one of the key ideas in this book and the whole sequence of my thought, starting with 1972. And another influence besides LSD and Neem Karoli Baba was my brother, Fred, who's a neurologist. neuroscientist.
Oh.
So because of talking to him over the years, I was kind of interested in trying to understand the psychedelic experience or the view of consciousness or existence of higher consciousness from the perspective of neuroscience. At that time, neuroscience was learning about the mechanisms, physical mechanisms of the biological brain through EEG technology. Multiple electrodes placed on the scalp, sampled in some small number of places what was thought to be continuous vibration of a chemical, biochemical, neurotransmitter, physical fluids, chemical clouds like calcium ions and so on.
Mm.
And complex physical vibrational system. We were struggling in, say, 1970.
Yeah, there's a complex electromagnetic field all these processes must be generating, and to try to decipher that must be a real zoo. Yeah.
Also, I have to confess that although I'm not a scientist, I have been, to some extent, a radio engineer over the years. I started as an amateur radio operator 70 years ago, at age 15.
AM bands, man. That's before SSB and all that.
The electromagnetic field, it seemed to me, was very difficult to understand. And now, all of the years, I still am not convinced that science has understood the electromagnetic field. However, the sonic field, that is, vibrations in air, vibrations in water, vibrations in solids, and so on, can be visualized, and therefore we really know a lot about them. We can imagine that vibrations in the electromagnetic field are similar to vibrations in a transparent fluid.
Like when you vibrate water, you can
vibrate
see the patterns.
Water. You have one of those Tibetan bowls, and you fill it with water, and then you run the stick around the outside, and it vibrates. You can see the waves on the surface of the water, and you can imagine what three-dimensional dynamic within the body are creating those surface waves. That this gives a kind of a metaphor to understand the complex dynamics in a brain. And in part one of the four parts of this book, Vibrations and Forms, devoted to the idea of cymatics, that is, observable vibrations in transparent fluids, of cymatics as a model of what's going on in the brain.
So certain meditations, while you're chanting, vibrate your brain to these certain frequencies that maybe attune you to some higher frequencies or higher awareness?
Yeah, more than that. It's just listening to music. Listening to the Tibetan bowl. It does affect not only the vibrations in your brain, but in your skin, in your stomach, in your gut, in your blood, in your heart, and so on. These very strong mechanical vibration around the body affect your thought. And so some kinds of meditation use sound as something to focus on. Others use light, like looking at a candle. So that's explored in part one of Vibrations and Forms.
So that came right after the psychedelic expansion.
Yes. And it was just devoted to the way neuroscience thought of the brain at that time, and maybe still today, as a material object. Some people still think that memory is somewhere located in the biological brain. And other people think that, well, there's more to the brain than the biological part. Anyway, that was my
explorations of that.
It seems to me that a lot of what you were exploring then was this idea of a resonant entrainment with some kind of measurable vibrational reality. And so you're looking into the relationship of things that are vibrating, such as sounds or water or the invisible planes of thought and consciousness, and you're looking to recognize where the source is and how those vibrations are related to the effects in the material world.
Exactly. The vibration is the vibrating thing that produces a shape. The vibrations and forms, the vibrations produce forms. Like mental vibrations might produce thoughts. Thoughts as forms. Forms in Plato's universe of form. The intellectual sphere and so on. So the cymatic idea was developed primarily by Hans Jaeny, a medical doctor in Dornach, Switzerland, a suburb of Basel, which was the home of anthroposophy.
Rudolf Steiner, yeah. Wow, it sounds like a...
Yeah, so Hans Jaeny was a medical doctor who got interested in vibrations and developed this technique of making them visible as a colored image on a screen. And the technique, this is where the idea of resonance comes in.
Yes, I've seen Randy Masters, a local teacher in this arena, was demonstrating this with some sand, where you put some sand on a metal plate and you vibrate it to certain frequencies. It forms different mandalas or patterns as you change the frequencies. Fascinating. And there's chaos between them, between the different patterns.
Yes, so the sand method of making vibration visible was developed in 1830 or so.
Wow.
By Ernst Chladni, who's the founder of the physics of acoustics, the physics of sound. So he was interested in improving the timbre of a musical instrument called the glass harmonium, in which you played upon a plate of glass with a cello bow to produce a sound.
Yes, I remember Ben Franklin was really interested in that.
Yeah, Ben Franklin developed it particularly. He was the great pioneer of the glass harmonium.
Yes.
So Chladni took the glass and he sprinkled the sand on it, and he discovered that the sand would collect in a certain linear patterns.
Yeah.
Of a network, which are called the Chladni nodal lines. Jaeny developed this further, where you could make replace the sand by transparent water, transparent liquid like water or glycerin. And then you look at it through a special optical system, and you can see where the water is displaced, like the sand grains were, onto the Chladni nodal lines. With different frequencies and different amplitudes, you would get different forms on the glass plate being vibrated. So you have the glass plate vibrating, then you have the fluid layer on top vibrating in response to, or in resonance, with the mechanical vibration of the plate, you see?
Was this your macroscope project, to build a device that could do this?
My macroscope that was built in 1974 is called the Jaeny Macroscope, after Dr. Hans Jaeny, because he died. I met him in 1972, and shortly afterwards he died, so I tried to continue his research by reproducing his laboratory, which he had generously shown me. And for a period of about 5 years, did research with chaotic vibration in fluids using the methods of cymatics. So chaotic patterns, ordinary sound waves, they're very regular. They look like sinusoids, like waves in the sea. But when you increase the amplitude, then you begin to get white water forming in a pattern of white water. So this seemed to be more the kind of form that we see in nature, and not sinusoidal forms, mathematically perfect forms. Chaotic white water kind of stuff. And that's what the mental field consists of. And the electromagnetic field, if you're an amateur radio operator and you turn up the power too high, and then you create a noisy signal. So that means that let's say we had an experiment that demonstrated telepathy, and you were a scientist and wanted to understand how this telepathy might work. You might think that brain number one has a vibrational pattern, which is then transmitted through space by electromagnetic field or mental field or some other field to brain number two, which then vibrates in resonance with brain number one due to the transmission of the vibrating pattern through the intervening space.
So it's a sympathetic resonance, would you say? Is that the principle?
Exactly. The word sympathy came into science.
Okay, and that's how our radio works, right? Radio and television, they use sympathetic resonance all the time to make our signals.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I have a transmitter and it has an antenna. And if you have a receiver and you have an antenna, then what's happening is that your antenna is vibrating in resonance with my antenna, and that's how the signal is actually.
So why not some neurophysiological element of our bodies and mind could do the same thing? Or maybe we got that idea from the mind-body equation.
Well, and so you're suggesting that we may have some sense that actually is attuned to a frequency that facilitates that quality of communication called telepathy. Like it's actually built into our physiology.
That's a conjecture, not mine, but many people have made.
Yeah.
Because serious experiments have shown that telepathy is not carried by the electromagnetic field, because people receive telepathy in shielded cages, Faraday cages.
Oh, so it's beyond. All right, well, more on this when we get back from our break.
Yeah, we're talking to Dr. Ralph Abraham. Welcome back to the show. We just broached the topic with our guest, Ralph Abraham from the university, on the idea of whether or not telepathy could be a real thing. And we're talking about sympathetic resonance as a possibility of how it all works.
And then I would like to just take us to the next chapter in your book, Ralph, which is when you went from studying the macroscope and the pure physics of vibration, and you started reintegrating with a theory of cosmology, and you got very into the discussion of what you're calling atomism and the various traditions that study consciousness and physics and science, and give us an understanding of that realm. And
well, don't forget telepathy, though.
Telepathy. Okay. Yeah. I don't mean to derail you, but
no,
I'm moving it forward.
Because it seemed to me like maybe the macroscope was some kind of, could be a telepathy training device. No?
Well, it...
Maybe the cell phones.
Well, what we're missing here is the connection between the... This is the big deal in the mind-body problem.
Yeah.
The connection between what I think that I'm going to... A thought that I'm going to send to you telepathically, and some intervening mechanical system, like the vibrating fluid.
Right, yeah, the ether. Like, what is the ether of thought?
Well, right? If there was an ether of thought, then maybe. But we don't know that, right?
Well, to transition then to part three of the book is about an atomic model for consciousness. And this was kind of an accident that happened to me around 20 years ago when I had a Fulbright grant to travel to any university that invited me. The Fulbright Foundation would pay the way, and I ended up going repeatedly to Japan and India and other countries. In India, I was invited to speak at a science institute in Calcutta, and after my talk, which was maybe something about cymatics and the continuous model for mentation, because in India, they have scientists that are total believers in meditation and telepathy, et cetera, et cetera. They don't have the division that we have in this country.
Even among the scientists.
Scientists came up after my talk and said, well, this sounds something like a model I made for the quantum vacuum. So I was introduced to the idea of the quantum vacuum for the first time, something that physicists have known about since 1936, I think.
How is that different from a non-quantum vacuum?
Well, yes.
Yes.
Quantum vacuum is not a vacuum.
It's not a vacuum to begin with.
Okay. It comes and goes. So Dr. Shishi Roy, his name, along with a German colleague, had developed a mathematical model for the quantum vacuum and published it in a paper in the 1970s.
Oh, so they had a mathematical model of how it worked? Is it a model of how it worked or how, describing its form?
Yes. A model for how particles could pop out of the vacuum and live briefly and then vanish again. So pair production and pair annihilation, all this happening visibly. I saw this when in my physics days when I was the engineer of the first large bubble chamber. And in the machine that we built, which made elementary particles traversing through space visible as tiny tracks of bubbles, you could see these pair production events happening. The two particles would appear and disappear. So muons, electrons, and so on.
Yeah, and that's one of the mysteries of the quantum, where things pop in and out of space. And you're like, where do they go?
So here they had a model for that. It's a phenomenological model. That is, the model behaved something like the quantum vacuum behaves, but doesn't explain how it works.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So the model was kind of a new type of mathematical model, similar to graph theory. So they had something called a dynamic complex network, and this was basically a graph, so you have nodes. They're not in space or anything, it's just a mathematical object. You have nodes connected by links. Some nodes are connected to some other nodes with a directed link. And then there's a kind of atomic clock or timepiece which clicks off a click, 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 time intervals. And with each new time interval, the states of these nodes change. And they change because of messages that are received from nearby nodes. And the node receiving the messages contains a rule book. If this, that, and the other is the state of the neighboring nodes right now, then I will change my state in this particular way, like appear in space, disappear in space, and so on. They had invented a new kind of mathematical model to put in the model closet.
So the person behind that, though, was your connection, right? The person who came up with that model? Was it a...
Yes. Uh-huh. He stood up at the end of my lecture and raised his hand and he said, I have an idea for you. Maybe our model could be used for your problem of consciousness. And so we formed a team and produced a book called Demystifying the Akash.
The Akash, Akashic, like in the Akashic record?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The kind of idea that there's an infinite... record of history and time?
Yeah, information in quantum space. Information in the quantum vacuum, for example.
Right. Yeah, and when I was reading this section, I was fascinated with the way that you were describing this atomistic model of the abstract universe and making a correlation between the universe of thought, which is immaterial, and the universe of matter, which is material. And you were trying to describe how the material world comes into being and goes out of being through this relationship of the different states, which are kind of like the way that animation is created out of cell frames. There's one where the state is on and one where the state is off, and each frame represents the shift from the frame before it to where it is now.
Exactly. Sometimes you have gradual changes that appear as a smooth motion, and sometimes you just have a sharp break, like a black edit in a movie. So the difference between mathematics and science is that we don't have to explain what these connections are. Mathematics says if there is a graph object, a dynamical network for the world of thought, and there's another one for the mechanics of the brain, and then apparently there's some connection from one network to another, that means there's actually a network of networks. And the different layers of consciousness comprise different nodes of a super network, each node of which is a network. And each node of that is a network, and so on.
It's networks all the way down, huh?
Networks all the way down.
Now, I'd like you to talk about how this all relates to cell biology, because there's a little...
Well, that's where you're modeling living systems.
But you did with Bruce Lipton take these insights and talk about cell biology, right?
Well, not really. Because I didn't know anything about cell biology. But we tried to bridge the gulf between his real science and my mathematical fantasies.
Where's your infinities of possibilities?
Yeah, there are people who carry the material metaphor of the brain to great extremes, like Roger Penrose and Stuart Hameroff. Yeah. Here you have a network of neurons, a neural network, and the neurons are connected by the dendritic connections, synapses, and so on between one axon and the next one. Mm. So a biological neural network, this is known in great detail, especially for smaller animals. Mm-hmm. So within a single neuron, though, there is a whole structure. And part of the structure is fluid that flows from one end to the other. At one end, you have a chemical factory making a neurotransmitter. And at the other end, you have the destination where the neurotransmitter is going to be released into the intercellular space and received by another neuron. Mm-hmm. So the neurotransmitter has to get from the factory to the transmitting end. That's done by fluid flow. The fluid flow is actually maintained by a pump. And the pump consists of the cytoskeleton, so-called, which is a vibrating object. You see, it's a cymatic model inside a neuron. Mm-hmm. So some people have suggested that the memories can be contained in quantum states of the cytoskeleton.
I was almost getting that idea that the quantum vacuum was a memory storage for the Akasha.
Yes, well, that's the fantasy of the Akashic record, which ostensibly comes from India, but actually was popularized by Madame Blavatsky, HPB, Alina B. Blavatsky, the founder of...
Theosophy.
There you go.
Theosophy, yes, anthroposophy.
Is Rudolf Steiner.
Theosophy in the development of a schism. Mm.
Yes, yes. It's like an infinite intelligent field that has information of all space and time that we have access to. It's a kind of a... now, in your combining of Eastern and Western thought, do you think such a thing actually exists?
Well,
can you hold on that thought for a second? We got to go to a commercial break.
Okay.
We'll be right back. We're talking to Dr. Ralph Abraham on the Akashic Record. This is recorded now. Welcome back to the show. We're talking to Dr. Ralph Abraham, and we were just bringing up the esoteric question of whether or not there is such a thing as the Akashic Record, that kind of cosmic Google that gives us access to universal knowledge. In your meditations, East and West, what do you think at this point?
Well, yes, I'm all for it.
Did you access it?
No, I think, but I don't know.
Okay, so it sounds good to you.
Okay. It's somehow an important idea in our world cultural history.
Yeah, so, it would be nice to have an internet that was bigger than our own that we had access to.
Well, yes, I'm pretty sure there is a bigger one.
Yeah, I have that feeling too.
Mm-hmm. And maybe the purpose of this one is to help us understand the bigger one.
Yeah, then maybe it's...
nodes and the bifurcation gradually develops in which they push apart, like vaccine and anti-vaccine people. Mm-hmm. So the Akashic Record was this idea put forward by Madame Blavatsky in her first book of 1880 or so. Mm. And she and another person developed a theosophy which became hugely popular around the year 1900. Then she died. And theosophy was taken over in the post-Blavatsky period by two of her leading followers in London, named Annie Besant and Charles Leadbeater. And they were talking about the astral plane, the astral plane was one part of the Akashic record. And they taught people to visit the Akashic plane and come back and report what they found there. These were like guided meditation trips or something.
Mm, they would go there and access and come back. It's like, like a vacation.
Mm-hmm. At the same time, there was a new development in technology, which is called colored printing, colored lithography.
Yeah.
And so the first colored book was actually their book, Annie Besant and Charles Led Dieter, on what people see in the astral plane.
Really? Wow.
And these were abstract colored images. They didn't vibrate because they were still pictures. But this book triggered huge developments in modern art, such as abstract expressionism and abstract animation.
Huh.
Awesome.
So, it reminds me of Jung's Red Book, where he was collecting dreams from about that
time. Oh, yes. Yes, but somehow the picture book, it had the colored pictures, and it really affected these visual artists. So it was a huge innovation in our cultural history, and it survives with the idea of the Akashic record. So if we, this is one idea, just a step beyond telepathy, but clairvoyance, dreams of the future, receiving information from the future, prediction, a forecast of the future, which later comes true. You receive it in a dream. So this clairvoyant phenomenon is very widespread. A lot of developments, reports in the literature. So the house session experience can be interpreted as kind of evidence for the astral field, which would have not only the present, but some future memories as well as past memories. Future memories are more like probabilistic, might happen or might not.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a probability matrix then. Future is a probability matrix.
What happens in the present moment is that the probabilities of the future are condensed into the reality which will be remembered as what actually happened.
So it sounds like you're suggesting with this understanding of the universe that, for one thing, everything is not predetermined, and that where we are in our present state is very important to opening up where we get to in the future. And yet, there is an element of it, since it is a field of vibration that is maybe in the abstract soul realm, that it's real, but we can only bring it into reality if we resonate with it and open the door. So it's somewhat predetermined, but it's also bifurcated. Like, we can go to an entirely different universe if we don't resonate with the one that we're aiming for or something. Good and evil being two possibilities, and in the present moment, the one we vibrate with is the one we get.
Something like that, yes. So that what we think, so if we pray, for example, or ask, then it has an influence on the future. It could be that such a major turning point where world cultural history is underway at this very moment, what Gregory Bateson called schismogenesis, the development of a schism. So we are seeing now, somehow on a global scale, a major change in the shape of world cultural history. And I don't know if it's true that what we think, like demonstrations in the street, actually affect how it comes out. Will the Taliban succeed in forming a government which is just antique laws?
No, I don't see how it can happen. We have modern communications there. Everyone there is brought up on the internet with smartphones. It's going to mutate the Taliban a lot, would be my prediction.
Me too.
Yeah.
Anyway, the future is hanging in the balance now.
Yeah, it is.
It always is, but it seems like more is at stake now because we have democracy versus autocracy.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is a lot at stake. Yeah.
Global. It's not just Trump and the United States.
No. Mm-hmm. No. Oh, we have a question from Gabby in New Jersey, who asks, what does Ralph think about the biblical application of cymatics? For instance, God speaking and creating matter. Is it merely symbolic of our ability to create matter with vibration? Is it a lesson in Buddhist right speech or right thinking?
Well, this is a whole category that I know very little about.
Okay.
Well, how about this? A little simpler question, since I'm looking at the book here. What do you have in this book of vibration and form to tell us about what is yoga and the soul. I know you addressed that a little bit, and the astral plane. I think all of these things are kind of related. I'd like to hear you elucidate how that looks to you.
Yeah, how it looks to me is that higher consciousness has a very elaborate structure, and there are layers that are more or less continuous all through space, and then there are blobs here and there which are associated with embodied people of the soul or the spirit or something like that. Part of the historical literature, the mystical literature on higher consciousness that's been written down by saints in the past, a literature which has evolved generation after generation and so on, in which the Bible, for example, those stories belong to this historical thread. So it seems to me that there are blobs of consciousness like individual souls that are actually connected in a network, like a neural network, comprising a higher dimensional object, which considered as a thing, is another layer of consciousness.
Hmm. You mean, so like the combination of very metaphysicians like Blavatsky and Steiner and such would create a network on another level?
In India it's called a Guru Kul, the school of gurus, like a school of fish.
Psychophysical Space-Time Masters Association of some kind.
Yeah, and it's possible that these people who communicate with us, these things, these souls, disembodied spirits, communicate with us, and they don't actually agree about everything. They have differences of opinion.
There's
good people, and there's liars and charlatans and so on. It makes it very, very difficult to navigate in these higher realms, and it's possible to take psychedelics and really get lost, or... You know, maybe we're all of us are pretty much lost anyway.
Well, there's just so many destinations. You can only visit a few.
I guess in science fiction, that would be like the Q continuum in the Star Trek mythos. These higher dimensional beings that where physical matter is almost trivial to them.
It could be that science fiction is our best mystical literature.
It's certainly served me.
And I like also the understanding that the invisible universe that is made of our thoughts, beliefs, our stories, the energy of our imagination is actually the realm that we're coming from and going to. And our physical experience is really just a tiny reflection of that.
Yeah, I like that idea. I think we are not the passive recipients of the wisdom of the gurus or the spirits living in the sky or something, because we actually influence them with our tremendous energy, vitality, creativity, and so on. So it's all an open system. Conscious will is possible.
Thank you so much, Ralph.
Yeah, thanks for being here, Ralph. We're in our final minute here. Do you want to mention your Hip Santa Cruz series as we go out?
The Hip Santa Cruz series has to do with the reason that I moved from Princeton to Santa Cruz. There you can read all about it.
It's in the Bookshop Santa Cruz. I've seen them there.
There's 1-5 available at Bookshop Santa Cruz and also on Amazon.com.
Excellent. Excellent. Mm. Thank you, Ralph, so much for being with us
really
for this hour.
Really great just, talking with you. Thanks.
Barely scratched the surface, but it was worth worth doing that. Thanks so much, and we'll be seeing you in the future.
KCO Santa Cruz.